I would venture that Iran also has a differing quality of isolation and treatment for the disease than some of the other countries do.
I would assume it has probably more to do with your socioeconomic group. Iran is not one of these build in one day countries. It has a great history. It goes all the way back to the Persian Empire. And so they're reasonably well skilled at these things. So assuming that they're spending the proper money and the proper time, they're certainly capable of doing anything that the first world is as far as isolation. Once again, I'm not quite sure because there's kind of two different things, I think, going on. One might be that they don't have the infrastructure to do the testing. So they other than people very ill and close to death, they don't test. So once they don't test, they don't announce. Or that they simply, on a political basis, would rather people not think of Iran as an infected state, and they've already kind of locked up the borders from surrounding countries. So I'm not quite sure what Iran's playing at. But technologically, they're a modern country in many ways.
But if their opinions get in the way, the result is the same.
Yes, indeed. And that's the problem with every country. Most countries in the world, unfortunately, these days, are not open democracies. They're either tyrannies or plutocracies or oligarchies or other things, in which a couple people control all the spigots of information. And so you got to take all this with a grain of salt. A lot of epidemiologists have kind of self-corrected the Chinese numbers by multiplying by three. I don't know if that's an accurate assessment, but that's not a terribly unreasonable one. On with the next. The United Kingdom's Weather Service, the Met Office, will spend $1.6 billion to acquire the world's most powerful climate supercomputer. The government has announced that's over 10 times more than its current Cray XC40 cost, but it will deliver more timely and accurate forecasts. That could make the difference in knowing whether your flight will be canceled or your street flooded, according to the service. The Met said that the computer will create a digital twin of our atmosphere with data like wind speeds, air temperatures and pressures, and more. It will create forecasts down to an area of just a little bit over half of a mile across compared to 6.2 miles currently. Around large airports, accuracy will focus down to about 1,000 feet. Once in service, it will not only generate better forecasts, including rainfall predictions, but help emergency workers deploy mobile flood barriers, balance the energy grid, and more. The Met also noted that it will also help services mitigate the effects of climate change and help support the transition to a low-carbon economy across the United Kingdom, said NBC. The supercomputer will also be used by universities for drug research, AI, energy storage, and other types of research. The first stage installation will go into service in 2022 and will be six times more capable than the current Cray XC40. 5 years later, it'll get an upgrade that will bump its performance a further three times, making it nearly 20 times more powerful. The cited price includes not just the hardware, but the running costs over 10 years. By contrast, the current model was acquired in 2014 and will be retired in 2022. The Met has yet to say which supercomputer it will be acquiring. The investment is by far the largest in the Met's history, but the department believes it will make a big difference, adding up to $23 in benefits for every pound spent. We'll be streets ahead of everyone else, said the Met's chief executive, Penny Andersby. Ultimately, it'll make a difference to every individual, every government department, every industry, as people see forecasts become steadily better. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie doke, and for my last story, Many of the potentially harmful chemicals found in our homes linger on walls and other surfaces, and suggests a new study out last Wednesday. Unfortunately, ventilating rooms with fresh air or cleaning surfaces might not do much to reduce our exposure to these contaminants. The new study published in Science Advances is part of a larger project involving researchers from several universities in the United States and Canada, intended to look at how environmental chemicals in the home are affected by everyday activities like cooking. It's called the House Observations of Microbial and Environmental Chemistry, or Home Chem to these guys. The research team wanted to find out what happened to these chemicals after people clean their floors or open a window. To do this, they set up a single-story test home where they could measure it in real time. They measured the real-time levels of 19 contaminants commonly found in indoor environments. These included isocyanic acid, also produced by cooking or smoking, nitrous acid, and many chemicals sent into the air from building materials and furniture. Outdoors, many of these contaminants quickly turn into vapor in the air, but indoors, according to senior study author Jonathan Abbott, a professor of chemistry at the University of Toronto, they often stick to the surfaces of a home, which act as a reservoir. These reservoirs then make it more difficult to get rid of these chemicals through simple airing and rooming out. Quote, our study shows that many of the molecules we breathe have large reservoirs on indoor surfaces that rapidly replenish the air after closing the windows, Abbott told reporters. Others have done similar work, but ours was the first with a wide suite of fast-time response instrumentation in a genuine indoor building. Let me drop for a sec. The team also found evidence that other methods of cleaning, like mopping the floors with a vinegar solution, can actually increase the levels of some contaminants in the air, at least temporarily. Importantly, though, the findings aren't proof that ventilation doesn't work at all to lower our exposure to these chemicals. Quote, I wouldn't say ventilation is fruitless or harmless. It may just be less effective than we think it may be, Abbott said. The team cites research suggesting that heavy or chronic exposure to these contaminants can be harmful to our health. Isocyanic acid, for instance, may be one of the reasons why cigarette smoke is so dangerous to our heart and circulatory system, while too much indoor nitrous acid might worsen lung conditions. But the researchers are careful to point out that their study wasn't designed to reveal how dangerous these lingering chemicals could be to people. Quote, we're measuring the chemicals and how these chemicals behave and move around in a variety of environments, but we're not looking at their health effects, said lead author Chen Yang, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Toronto at Abbott's lab. There's a lot of potential study on that, too, but this isn't our expertise, he said. That said, better understanding of how these chemicals behave in our homes will hopefully make it easier to learn how we get exposed to them. If many contaminants are readily found on surfaces and not so much in the air, Chen noted, then we might need to be more worried about skin contact and breathing them in. Regardless, Abbott said, there are ways to lessen our exposure to common sources of pollution in the home. He said, quote, in general, it is probably best to use fewer cleaning and air freshening agents, end quote. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GS. Okay, I think I've gotten to the end of my little stories, and it's time to make way for Paul. But once again, just want to remind everyone, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you have any questions you'd like me to relay to Paul, or if you have any questions for me or topics or reference materials with links or suggestions for puzzlers, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the stories that I mentioned will be available on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. And as I said before, if you need an audio stream, if your radio is acting up and your Echo Link is acting up, then I provide an audio stream at technet.ac2gs.com. And now I shall pass the baton on to Paul for the space report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good, Maury. Interesting topic. And hopefully we have a couple here with the SpaceNet report. Small launch vehicle companies have really taken off. I mean, a few years ago, there was, I think, about 15 small startup companies. And some of them, you know, went away, and some of them took off. There's a new one called Astra, A-S-T-R-A. And about 5 years ago, they started a company. Two fellows, Adam London and another guy, Chris Kapp. And it's pretty much been secretive. Their idea is to launch small rockets, you know, with only 100 pounds or so into orbit. There's a market for that. SpaceX has now gone with larger satellites, crew vehicles to the space station, that type of thing. There's some smaller companies that have been successful, like Rocket Lab. They've been launching the Electron rocket from New Zealand. There's another company now, it's Astra, and they plan on launching actually their first rocket to orbit tomorrow. And, you know, it's, again, only about 100, 200 pounds at the most will be able to launch into orbit. They competed with this DARPA. DARPA had this program that competed with other companies. And DARPA is going to hand out $2 million if you could just launch a vehicle, you know, in a short period of time. They would say, okay, here's the payload, just let's see if you can put it up there. And they extended that to $10 million to launch two vehicles within 10 days. And there were a lot of companies that were interested, and they got involved, and then they dropped out. But this company, Astra, stayed with it, and tomorrow they're going to try to do that. And they're launching from Alaska, what I call the Kodiak launch facility. They since changed the name to the Pacific Launch Facility. But it's up in Kodiak, Alaska, and they plan on launching this rocket. It's not a very big rocket. It's only, I think, about 40 feet tall. Give you an idea of a Falcon 9 that SpaceX launches. It's 250 feet tall. This thing is very short. It's only about 5 feet in diameter. But they think it might make it. It's got five engines on it. They make their own engines in California. And they are called Delphin engines. And the Delphin engine is, they started off around 3,000 pounds thrust when they were testing it. And they upped it to 6,000. So there's five engines on board, and that would be a total of 30,000 pounds of thrust. And that, you know, for a long enough period of time, that they think that will get them to orbit. That succeeds, they're going to launch from another launch complex in the same place, from Kodiak, Alaska. And if they can do that within 10 days, they'll get their $10 million. But more importantly, they'll be able to get a lot of small contracts that are already on that manifest. People really believe that it's going to work out for them. And they have these electric pumps that are going to pump the fluids into the rockets. Similar idea to what Rocket Lab is doing. Rocket Lab launches their rocket is about twice the height of this thing, but they have nine engines on their Rutherford engines, and they run electric powered engines, lithium ion batteries to run the turbines. And these people are doing something similar. They're using pumps to pump the fluid into your combustion chambers. But if they could do it, they could do it for, you know, a very inexpensive price per launch. I think like a couple of million dollars per launch. Compare that to Falcon 9, which is $62 million per launch. And they say that's cheap, which is true, because it's probably three times the price of, you know, what NASA used to go with. So looking forward to seeing those people take off. I mean, only, what, almost 15 years ago, SpaceX was doing this. They started launching small rocket, maybe about 80 feet tall, from Omelek Island. Omelek Island is one of the islands in the Kwajalein Islands, which is part of the Marshall Islands. He chose that because it was right near the equator, and you get the extra push if you're near the equator. You don't need as much thrust to get the get an equivalent amount of weight to orbit, say if you were further up in latitude. And Elon Musk started off with Falcon 1. You know, he's got the Falcon 9 now. He had the Falcon 1 back in 2000 and around the 2005-2006 time frame. He launched the first launch, and it failed. NASA told him, if you can get, you know, get something to orbit as a commercial company, you know, we'll give you a big time contract. And then again, he tried again, and it failed. And the third time it failed, and he had enough money left for a fourth launch. The way he got all that money was he had originally opened up PayPal. He started PayPal with somebody else, and then eBay had bought it up for like $1 billion or whatever it was, and that's how he got his money. But he was going through money left and right with the launch complex and the Kwajalein Islands and three launches, and he had enough money for one more launch. And sure enough, he made it to orbit, and now look at him today. I mean, he's really thinking about sending rockets to not only the moon but to Mars. It's really really out there. So you never know where this company is going to go. Right now, this company only has like 180 employees. They came out of nowhere. Probably a month or two ago, I never heard the name, but now, you know, now of course it's being advertised because they've got to clear the area, make sure that, you know, nobody's in the way, no boats downrange. They're going to do a polar launch. They launch to the south, and they wind up going over the poles that way. Make sure they don't come near any land. So I thought that would be an interesting topic. This is WS to answer any questions. Well, I hope Astra makes it. I really do. The more the merrier. And there's so many companies trying to do that, just that. You have Virgin Galactic. They spun off one of their businesses. Now they call it Virgin Orbital. And within probably, they were supposed to have done it by now, but probably within a month or two, they should launch their first small payload type of rocket to orbit. And that one's going to be launched from a 747. You know, he's got a 747. He built this carrier that's, you know, off the left part of the wing. And he plans on launching satellites to space that way. So that's another competitor. A couple of them have gone out of business. Vector was doing very good, but you know, they had launched a suborbital flight. They were going to try for orbital. That didn't work out. There's another company I'm watching, Firefly. They haven't made it yet either, but I really believe they're going to make it. There's a bunch of money behind Firefly. And that will probably be sometime this year as well. Let me drop it. Okay, talking about Mars, the InSight spacecraft landed there last year, November of last year. And InSight was the, it's not a rover, it's in one position. The idea is to test for what Mars is made of. You know, they have the thermal bowl on board that they plan on, the idea was to hammer it all the way into the ground, like 15 feet into the ground. That was one main experiment. The other one is all these seismometers that they have. Seismometers are working great. You know, it worked soon after they landed. But they've had trouble with this mole. And this mole is like this 14-inch long, let's call it a pipe with a point on the front. And inside it has an electric motor, weight near the point of it on the inside. And as the motor turns, it turns, and this starts pulling up against this cam. The cam is spring-loaded, and when it gets, you know, to the end of the cam, it slips off, and this weight comes flying down and hits the front of the mole. And this happens over and over, similar to what they have, you know, if you need to, let's say, run a line underneath your driveway, you know, electrical line or a pipe. Or, you know, they have these moles that are pretty much self-propelled. You know, they have hook up power to it, and off they go. It's that type of an idea. And they, by now, it should have been, you know, 16 feet underground, but it didn't work out. The engineers have been trying to figure out ever since. They've tried different things, and it gets, you know, a few inches into the ground, and then it starts to pop back up again. And they realized over time where they landed, the ground is relatively soft, and they, you know, if it was a little more, you know, packed ground, it would work better, because as this thing hammers into the ground, most of the picking up friction from the surrounding dirt around it. So it starts to go down, and then it, you know, it doesn't have enough grab of dirt behind it to hold it, and it starts jumping out of the hole, and it creates this hole, and they've gone through a lot of problems trying to make this thing work. Different things they've tried, and everything's failed, but now, including one thing they tried, they have a scoop. They could, you know, pick up dirt if they had to with the scoop, and they tried pushing on the ground next to it, thinking, well, that's going to work. It's going to put, you know, put some pressure on the surrounding it, and it worked a little bit, but sure enough, it started popping out again. So, you know, I was wondering right from the beginning, why don't they try to take that scoop and push straight down on the top of the mole. The reason they didn't do that is because this ribbon cable, you know, it's a little bit bigger than, I don't know, it kind of looks like a ladder line coming off the top of the mole, and they don't want to ruin that. That's what powers it. That's what it's what sends the information back about the temperature inside the planet. And they didn't want to ruin this mole, but then they have an exact duplicate of InSight in Pasadena, California, and sure enough, they ran some tests on it, and they believe they can successfully do it. They can, you know, push that mole in a certain way, and then with that scoop, push down and get some direct pressure above it, and once it gets, you know, underground, or, you know, almost completely covered, it should hammer itself all the way into the ground. And, you know, for extra insurance, they're gonna, you know, once it does get low enough, they're going to take the scoop and put some dirt on top of it to try to add to, you know, the strength of the surrounding ground around that mole. And hopefully that works, and if that does, then it'll be a complete success. They got nothing but time. The thing is solar-powered. It's got these two gigantic round solar panels, maybe, you know, 8 or 9 feet in diameter, picking up sunlight from the sun. It gives them around 600 watts to play with. And otherwise, the mission was a very good success, except for the mole problem.
W2RY.
Hi, Joe. How you doing? Go ahead.
Yeah, just tuned in over here. You're talking about, I guess, the stuff on the Mars stuff, correct?
Yeah, QSL, the InSight mission that went up, landed a little over a year ago, November 2018. Yeah, back to you, Joe.
I'm sorry, my IP stuff, I knew it would have cut you out. You're talking about the Mars stuff, correct?
QSL, yes, QSL.
What I thought about, because Dick has said this numerous times, that there's very little air up there, on the surface of the planet. It's very extremely thin, but it's also at a very, very high velocity. Has that ever been a factor for them to consider if this rover rooms around and gets at a certain angle that the wind could actually catch it, topple it over? Would that ever be a problem for this these automated systems that are trying to, move around up there? Back to you.
Okay, Joe. First of all, the InSight mission, that's not one of the rovers. That's the one that is just landed in one position, and it's going to stay that way. Similar to the Phoenix mission that launched back in 2007. In fact, it looks like the Phoenix mission. The Phoenix mission went up to the northern latitudes and found ice under the ground, and, it had a scoop on it as well. But this one has the heat probe, and it has the seismometers on it. It's very, very successful so far. But, you're talking about the rovers themselves. Right now we only have one active rover on Mars, and that's Curiosity, and that's soon to be joined this July 17th, by the Mars 2020 rover that will be going up. And as far as wind goes, you can get 180-mile-an-hour winds, and if you were standing there, you'd barely even notice it, because the air is so thin that it's so rarefied that, even though it's going 180 miles an hour, there's not that many molecules that are hitting you. So then I think it's less than 1% of what we have here. I think it's 7/10 of 1%, something in that nature. Very, very thin, but the wind definitely moves. They have anemometers on some of the rovers, all of the rovers. They know the wind speeds and all of that. But it can't, pick up the rover and blow it around. The other rovers had solar panels on it. I thought of that when they first went up, with the thin air, they don't even feel it. Back to you, Joe.
I wasn't even thinking about that. As far as the solar panels acting like a wing or something like that, even in the extremely thin atmosphere, if they would have enough pressure if they turned the thing a certain way. But I guess if they got a team of smart guys for it, so the thing doesn't get turned over on you. Okay, interesting. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, the same theory that we could stand here and 20-mile-an-hour winds, doesn't bother us at all, You go in the water and have that water move past you. If that water's moving 20 miles an hour, you're not going to be able to stand still, because there's so many molecules in the water compared to the air. That's the way I think of it. Up on Mars, it's so thin. It's all carbon dioxide, but, still gas. It's enough to affect the landing of these vehicles when they come in from out of space. When we deorbit here, we come back at 17,000 miles an hour. Those things come land on Mars at 13,000 miles an hour. But still, those heat shields get hot. Even so, the air is so rarefied there that it does affect them at those speeds. But not on the ground. Not at only 180 miles an hour. I don't even know if you would feel it. I think if you were an astronaut, you could just stand there and maybe you'd feel it, but I don't think it would blow you over. Any other questions, Joe?
No, I'll just continue to listen for a while. Okay, interesting. Thanks, Paul. I mean, to Roy White.
There we go. Okay. Let's just move on to another topic. I was have to cover the manned space program at the National Space Station. You have three people up there right now, one American woman, a man, and one Russian. And they were about to be joined by three new people. Chris Cassidy would be one American, and then two Russians, guy Nikola Tikhobana and Andrei Babkin. They were going to go up in April, but one of the Russians hurt his eye and was some kind of an accident. So, just like the old days, you always had a backup crew, and sure enough, they're going to use the backup to him, and they decided, well, the other Russian too. So two new Russians, but Chris Cassidy, the American, is still going to go up. So that was a weird switch, you know, last minute type of thing. That's what they're going to do. These two that were going up, Nikola and Andre never flew before to the space station. And they're going to be replaced with two other guys. I think one guy has been up there at least twice. So I guess maybe Chris Cassidy's in better hands with them. And I'll be glad to see the American space program get on the way where you don't have to depend on the Russian Soyuz rockets. That'll be here. That'll be great. So what'll happen is they'll join the other three, and they'll stay like that for, I don't know, a couple of weeks or a month or so. And then the other three are going to come back. That's only going to leave three on board, Chris Cassidy with the two Russians. So in case something goes wrong on the outside of the space station, you know, you have to do an EVA. They never send one person out. It's always two people. So as a contingency plan, just in case this happened where they have just the three, they made sure that the Russians also knew how to do a spacewalk in our spacesuits. You know, they have their own spacesuits. They have the all-land spacesuits for the Russians, but when you leave out of the Quest airlock, that's the American side, you need to go out with American EVA suits. So in case there's a problem, they'll be able to do that. Now, that's going to stay like that all the way until, I think, October. So it'll just be a three-man crew. And the reason I feel for this is U.S., we don't want to pay the Russians any more money than we have to. We've been paying them, I think, something like $85 million a seat or something now. Kept getting higher and higher. And they're not going to do that anymore. So they're going to just leave it this way until either Dragon with the crew goes up or Starliner with the Boeing crew goes up, either one of the two. I think Dragon is going to make it first, you know, SpaceX. And probably, they have a date. They actually have May 7th, but, you know, that could change. But they actually have a date for the first launch. And once they do that successfully and bring those people back, the next crew that will go up will be staying on, long term, another 5 or 6 months like they usually do. They'll get back to normal. In fact, it will be eventually better because these new spacecraft, the Dragon crew vehicles and the Starliner by Boeing, will be able to, once they get the rotation going right, carry four people at a time. They'll leave, you know, one spacecraft attached to the space station all the time. You always need that as a lifeboat in case it's a problem. So you'll be able to have four people from that there, and you'll have three from the Russians. And instead of having a permanent manifest of a crew of six people, you'll have a permanent crew of seven, which will essentially double the amount of science that they're able to do. Right now, the science is going to drop down to, like, practically nothing. You know, they think they're only going to get, like, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 hours out of science per week the way it is, because there's so much maintenance and things that have to go on with the space station with only three people on board. You know, you're looking at, like, this is like a skyscraper in space. They say it even feels like that. If you do an EVA and you go outside and you look up, you know, one side down the other, you know, you feel like you're standing on the outside of it, like a 35-story building, you know. So you have a crew of three trying to handle this. It's going to cut back on the science. One good thing is that a lot of the science that's done, you actually don't need a crew there. It's being done by mission control in Houston and another mission control in Germany. And, you know, they have their own way to do tests without a crew at all. You know, so those tests will continue to go the way they always do. But the ones that you really need a crew for, which is, you know, really actually most of the tests. I think there's hundreds of tests going on at one time on the ISS. That's what happens. Let me drop it and see if there's any questions or comments. This is WS2N for the space portion of the tech. Okay, another topic I came across recently is the New Horizons spacecraft. You know, that's the one that, you know, a couple of years, three years ago or so, passed Pluto on a July 4th flyby, and then it kept going all the way out and eventually passed this other object 40 miles out, Ultima Thule. Since then they've changed the name to some name I can't even pronounce, but some Indian name, unfortunately. Ultima Thule was good enough, but they crossed that off the list. That was the one it looked like, you know, a snowman in space, one big body and then another smaller one, and they were attached, you know. So they passed that around 40, a little over 40 AU, astronomical units from the sun. And now they're out to around 44 astronomical units there, way out there, way past Pluto, you know, past Neptune. This one guy, Stern, Adam Stern, his first name, this fellow Stern is the principal investigator for the New Horizons. And they came up with this idea for a parallax project. They're going to get volunteer astronomers on Earth to point their telescopes to the sky at a certain date, sometime I think in April, to look at and take pictures of two stars, one Proxima Centauri, that's the closest star to us, and then there's another star called Wolf 359. Wolf 359 is, I believe, the second closest star outside of the Centauri system. I think that's a three-star system. But they want to get astronomers to take pictures of it, and they're going to try to figure out the exact angle, the parallax angle, between that and New Horizons. New Horizons still has a camera, it's working. And on that same time, the exact same day, they're going to take pictures with New Horizons of Wolf 359 and eventually Proxima Centauri. And that's going to give them an accurate measurement of parallax. You know, they've done this for years. The parallax system, and if you're looking at a star, nearby star, you can look at it, let's say, on January 1st, and then 6 months later, in June, you could take another picture of it. You could figure out the angle, and therefore, through trigonometry, know pretty much exactly how far that star is away. Of course, that works good with close stars, but it doesn't work with the ones that are further away. With this, this will give them a more accurate measurement because they'll be using, instead of, let's say, you know, we are 93 million miles away from the sun. We'll call it 100 million miles. When we do a parallax on Earth 6 months apart, it's 200 million miles apart. That's it. That's only, you know, the equivalent of 2 AU. This is 44 AU. So you're going to have, you know, it would be like having eyes, two eyes, one eye on Earth and the other one at 44 AU, looking at a couple of stars, and it's going to give you a high accurate measurement, and it's also going to give you a very good 3D effect. One of the people on Adam Stern's group is, you know, he's got all these scientists. One of the guys is Brian May. Brian May is, you know, if you know that, the group Queen from years ago. Ryan May, he was he's a guitarist. He's still with the group. And We Will Rock You, the song, you know, that's what they did. And a couple of other great ones. Well, he's, you know, when he was doing all that, he was studying all the time. He liked science, he liked astronomy, and eventually he got his degrees and everything. He's considered a doctor. He's got his doctorate in all of this stuff, and he's one of the people on that group. He's an expert in 3D, so he's going to develop the 3D, you know, what this looks like from his point of view, getting all the results from this parallax. So they actually look for astronomers. I guess you could go to the John Hopkins website, put in Wolf 359 parallax, and figure out a way to join that group if you feel a need to do that. This is WS2M. Any questions or comments? Okay, we do a lot of interplanetary stuff, and so do these other countries. Japan has now just put money to a new mission. They would like to fly, not to Mars, but to Phobos. Phobos is one of the moons that orbit Mars, and they were like, you know, it's only about 14 miles in diameter. And what they plan on doing is going there, the spacecraft, and they're getting so close to it, they're going to land on it, and then they're going to pick up some of the gravel, the dirt, or regolith, whatever you want to call it, and put it into a canister and have it return to Earth. They're also going to have a little rover on there, too, that they're going to let go and ride around. Similar to what they did with Ryugu. They recently went to Ryugu, an asteroid, with Hayabusa 2 that Dr. Roy covered many times on this net. And they were so successful with the Hayabusa 2 project that something had, you know, the ability to bring material back and put rovers on the surface. They're going to do a similar thing with the Phobos and hope to bring back a sample. It'll be the first time anybody brings back a sample from Mars, which would be quite successful if they do that. And we plan on eventually doing that with this rover that's going up, the 2020 rover that's going to launch on July 17th. But it's only halfway done. They're going to leave canisters on the planet, a little core boring tube that eventually a sample return mission from NASA will eventually go to get them and return them to Earth. But this one is a complete mission. They plan on doing this by 2024. They actually have a month, September 24th, of doing this for a launch. Going out to Phobos. They plan on using their new rocket. They have the H-3, which is an improved, upgraded version of the H-2. They have the H-2A and the H-2B. The H-2A launches all their communication satellites and things like that. The H-2B launches a large cargo vehicle, actually the largest one that goes to the space station. On the H-2B. Now, they're coming up with the H-3, which is, I think, going to debut sometime this year. So, that's Japan's efforts. We do have NASA is involved. They are sending one of their instruments on board that mission to Phobos. So, we'll follow that as the years go on, hopefully, God willing. And this has been WS2N. Any questions or comments, because I'm going to, come to a grinding halt here. Any questions? Okay. A few more years than that, there is a study going on that they want to send a rover to Venus. So that should be interesting. We'll cover that at a certain time. Right now, they're just studying how they're going to go about doing this. You know, what kind of machinery are we going to have to build to ride around on Venus. And they actually have a plan for that. Any questions, comments? If not, we'll turn it back to Dick. Dick's back there, and we'll go over to Roy. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Don't hear him. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N.
Okay, Paul, thanks a lot. There's only 5 minutes left, so there's no real time for any of the other stories. They take up a little bit more than 5 minutes. So I will remind people, as I frequently do, that if they have any questions of a technical nature for Dick, and they're not able to get on the TechNet, or if they have anything that they would like Paul to take a look at, or if you have a topic or question or want to refute something that I said or want to send me some reference material that I can review on subjects of interest, or if you have any puzzlers, always looking for puzzlers. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything I talked about is already on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, and you can read up further on those things, and feel free to Google the subjects that come up in our conversation. And as always, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Dick, certainly, and Paul for the opportunity to do this here every Sunday night, and thanks to everyone who participated, and even to those who just sat quietly and listened and didn't send me any angry emails. Thanks to everyone. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Have a great week. Have a safe week. And I will be clear. Over to Paul.
Very good. And we'll be here next week, hopefully. And tomorrow is the club InfoNet. That would be on this repeater. You don't have to be a member to check into that one. And pretty much it. And the good news is, by the way, Ray, my rig kept going tonight, Roy. I didn't get any cracklies when I was transmitting on my end here. But what we talked about in the chat net, chat room was, it's been confirmed. If I can go this long, I think it's nailed. 73, have a good day. AC2GS, WS2N, bye-bye. Anybody that wants to use the repeater, by the way, it will stay on for another hour. Shut down like it used to. WS2N.
WS2N, KC1SAM. Well, I got a question for you. Just thinking about it.
Good evening, Sam. How you doing? KC1SAM, WS2N. Back to you.
Yeah, very good. I hope you're well as well. The mission is going to collect samples and leave them there to be gathered at a future time. I mean, that sounds a little crazy to me. When do they expect to go back to gather those samples on Mars?
Yeah, there's no plan. So whenever they decide to set up a sample return mission, they'll do it, which would mean one of two things. They'd have to land in roughly the same area that this thing will land. And they would have to have this rover that's nuclear-powered, if it's still running, drive over, pick up the samples wherever they leave them. They'll know exactly where they leave these things. They know where they are within every inch on Mars. So they'll be able to pick it up and bring them over to the landing vehicle. And the present plan is, it lands and it's got a rocket within this lander. Samples would be put back on to that rocket with a robotic arm from the lander. That's the present plan. I mean, this could be many years from now. If the new rover, 2020 rover, has failed for any reason, so they would have to send another small rover to go get those samples. So, but I mean, that's what they think. You know, each one is, you know, they'll know, you know, where it came from. They'll, you know, and if they can ever get it back, they said it would be very valuable information. Back to you, Sam.
No, I'm sure they'll know exactly where it is. That's not the issue. The issue is, like you said, if you send another mission, you've got to land in the same spot where you've already been. Go around and collect samples that have been collected who knows how long in the past. Oh, it sounds crazy to me. Like the cart before the horse, you know, like get something that can come back first and then you can get some samples and put on it. But, oh well, I guess I did hear it correctly then. All right. Enough of that. Good chat. Nice hearing your report.
That time you complete.
Thanks, that ends a little bit earlier, by the way. So, KC1SM, I'll be clear. Always good to talk to you, Paul.
Very good, Sam. Yeah, and this is the one, I don't know if you heard, you know, maybe about a year ago, I was talking about the mission that's going to go up. It's going to have the helicopter attached to the bottom of the bottom of the rover. And it's going to fly around. Do you remember that story? That's this mission coming up in July. It's got these blades, like almost 4 feet long, you know, and two blades. It's not like a drone. It's like a helicopter. It's going to fly for, like, you know, fly for a minute, land, recharge its battery. It's got a little solar panel on top. It's quite a deal. I'm surprised they got that approved, talking about being outrageous. They talked about that years ago, and then sure enough, they eventually got that approved. That's really way out there. I mean, you know, they need these great big blades because the air is so thin. And they're supposed to, I forget what RPMs they're going to spin at. I got to see this thing. Back to you, Sam.
N1YDY. It was supposed to be some ridiculous RPM rate, too, to get that going. I guess they've legalized drugs in Texas, right? Whatever. They already have rovers that can go for miles, you know what I'm saying? Proven technologies. But anyway, yeah, oh, this one is going up in July. Okay. Let me get over there. I think that's Hank. Pick it up.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. And, Paul, I just wanted to jump in and say hi to both of you, Tim, in particular, here before you guys signed for the night. It's been a while since I danced to talk with you, and I'm sure everything was still going okay with you.
Very good, Hank. Yeah, doing good. Yeah, well, finished another net, and it's shorter, but I think it's better. That's why I freeze up the repeater, too, for a little bit afterwards, you know. The other way, you get off and bam, it's gone. You know, if anybody wanted to say one last word, you know, you have to have a good memory and remember all the way to next week. Back to you, Hank.
Well, my memory's not that good, so worked pretty well for me. Like I said, I just wanted to jump in and say hi to both of you. So with that, I'll say 7-3, and you guys have a good week.
Yeah, I'll pick it up. Let me see if I got it. Casey, when I say, yeah, I'm very good, Hank. Thank you. Just haven't been on a lot. I guess to confess, watching a couple of things on Netflix now and then. That's about it. But you know, I listen a lot. Usually have the radio on at times, so don't hear bits and pieces. But everything's good here. Hope things are well with you. So nice chatting with you.
Okay, Sam. 73 to you, Hank. Nice hearing from you. I'll be back next week. Have a good night. WS2
clear. 73 is KC1SAM clear.
Yeah, Paul, WB2BXO here.
Yeah, WB2 XO. I always forget the suffix. No, it's XO. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. It's Frank. WB2BXO. I've heard all kinds of versions of my call over the years, but in this case, I did not say it clearly. In any case, and if you want, we can defer this to the technical portion of the next week. I was wondering if anybody had any thoughts on lightning cables, you know, the cables for the iPhone and iPad, because I'm finding some of the less expensive ones I buy seem to be unreliable. I was wondering if anyone had some thoughts on that, Paul. Go ahead.
I don't. I really don't know. But I don't know, but Roy is still here. I know Dick's gone, so definitely next week. But no, I can't help you on that one, Frank. But, see if anybody's out there.
C2GS.
You got it, Roy. I don't know if you heard Frank's question.
Yeah, I heard Frank's question. I've had the same experiences. I've tended to err on the side of if I felt like spending too much money buying Apple Lightning products. The generic ones sometimes work, sometimes don't work, and sometimes fail over time. So it's sort of a crapshoot. It's based upon whether the few choices that Apple provides are all that you need, and if you don't choke at the markup that they request. I have both. I buy some third party that I consider to be consumable, that it'll last for X number of months, and when it gets a little wonky, I throw them away.
Yeah. I looked it up online, and they said the some thoughts seem to be they stop working after a couple of months is because they get damaged if you don't handle them very carefully, which makes a certain degree of sense. But what I'm finding is sometimes they don't seem to work well out of the box. They do weird things, like they charge the phone to 80% and stop charging, and things like that. So not certain the problem is the connector, but I've been thinking the same thing, that the most reliable are probably the ones that Apple makes. Of course, they're also the most expensive. Another thought I had is of some kind of impedance mismatch issue, but I don't know if impedance mismatch applies to digital signals.
Yeah, Frank, the Lightning port is a really complicated digital chip with handshaking and all manner of things. It's apparently very easy to screw it up over time, so that's as good as any excuse that it's mechanically not as sturdy as the Apple products are. If I go third-party these days, I try and go with well-known third-party names as opposed to random collections of letters that some Chinese manufacturer groups together for about an hour and a half. So something like Anker, there's a few on Amazon. I sort of go along with the review ratings as a guideline. Because there are some, especially in the early days, there were some versions of that Lightning connector that were complete wastes of money. You plug it in and it just sits there and does nothing. So I would either stick with Apple if you can tolerate the markup and the sizes and options are sufficient for you, or find a reasonably well-known third party with good reviews on something like Amazon. And again, assume that you're renting it as opposed to buying it.
Something like you got to rent Microsoft Office now, which I think is weird. Anyway, but that's a whole other conversation. Anyway, okay, yeah, that's what my wife and I went through the reviews on Amazon and wound up buying a couple of Anker cables, which we're trying. It sounds like you kind of came to the same conclusion. Thanks, Roy. Very interesting. And, thanks for the physics and space stuff. All really interesting, of course. Star 3,
WB2BXO. T2RIW is here. I wonder if John, WA2VDH, is still on frequency. I just thought of something. Looks like he's not. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Frank. I enjoy talking about these things. Sometimes
I'm sort of amazed that I can find other people who are interested in hearing about it and talking about it as well. So it's my pleasure, Frank. Have a good week.
Just curious, Roy, I know I can probably look it up on your website. Is your background both in medicine and in physics?